Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Swim podcast, man. Swim podcast.
Welcome to episode 33 of Someone Who Isn't Me. My name is Daniel P. Carter, and my guest on this one is the titan of the world of comics, Grant Morrison. He's written and created for both DC and Marvel, working on legendary books like Batman and Superman and X-Men and Green Lantern and Wonder Woman and Animal Man and Doom Patrol and Swamp Thing and Fantastic Four and The Invisibles, among many others. His TV show Happy just concluded its second season on Netflix. And he's currently working on an adaptation of The Invisibles, which we discuss in the podcast. He's got an MBE for services to film and literature. His dad was also an MBE, which is incredible, I think. And his book Super Gods was a New York Times bestseller. His influence on culture and occulture is truly enormous. So when I first put my wish list together of guests who I'd want to come on Swim, Grant was on there. It has taken a few near misses for our schedules to coincide, but when his wife Kristen emailed to say that they'd be in London and he'd be able to record the episode the day before his 60th birthday, which was also Brexit Day, I was super stoked. It was the first time I met them both. They were really cool and very chill, so by the time we actually started recording the episode, I think we got stuck into it straight away, and we spoke about magic, where we find ourselves in this current point in time and space, comics a bit, and also the collaborative nature of writing for TV. And to be honest with you, I found the whole thing well inspiring and mind-blowing, and I hope that you do too. I think you will. Grant's an incredible thinker, and he's a creative whirlwind, and his list of works over his career to date is so vast, we barely touched on any of it, which I guess is kind of cool because there was a lot of other stuff to discuss. I actually cut a little bit out of the podcast where we spoke about one of the apocryphal stories that's part of Grant's history, I guess, because we felt like it was something that he'd been asked to talk about in depth several times already, and it would have been kind of treading the same ground. But if you're interested, because it is amazing, you should go and check out. There's a bunch of other podcasts he's done. There's a really good documentary, which you can find on Prime about him. Yeah, it's ace. It's all out there. I also want to give a little bit of background about the portrait I painted of him for the cover of this episode, because regular listeners and subscribers will know that I make an oil painting of each guest that comes on the pod for the cover. And for this one, as it's episode number 33, which is a truly auspicious number that represents creativity and inspiration, and it's also a number that holds a lot of personal attachment for me, I've got a thing about threes and nines, I thought it deserved something special. So as you'll hear, we discuss the idea that reality is multifaceted, and the way that we view things at any one time is exactly that. We're viewing it in one way at one point in time, just one aspect of something that exists on multiple planes, which got me thinking about reality, or matter, I guess, being represented by the Platonic solids, which then led me to thinking about Kepler's drawings and what is known as Kepler's cosmic cup, which kind of represents all the Platonic solids nesting within each other and their correspondence to celestial bodies as well. And then that sits within this kind of weird goblet type thing. And as Grant discusses his first truly magical exploration being a working of the Bornless ritual, which if you're interested in, is also known as Liber Samech, or The Headless Right. There's an amazing, where could you look that up? Go and look up in Gordon White's book, Chaos Protocols. There's a very succinct reading of the ritual. You can look it up online. But if you want to really get into it, there's a guy called Jake Stratton Kent who's written a really good dissertation, I guess. It's a short thing, but it's worth checking out if you're interested on the Bornless Ritual or Headless Rite, whatever you want to call it. So I figured that placing his head, as it's a symbol of the repository of ideas, inside the cosmic cup seemed kind of fitting. I also like the idea of like marrying the two things of like the feminine chalice with the masculine bald head, because it reminded me of like this old Crowley self-portrait where he drew his bald head in a very phallic way. So yeah, it's kind of the head in the cup, you know what I'm saying? But to clarify, I am not calling him a dickhead. And no, I didn't mean any disrespect by decapitating him. He's one of the coolest people I've ever met. Yeah. So with that as a heads up, pardon the pun, please enjoy this conversation with Grant Morrison. I wanted to talk about comics, TV, art, creativity, life, and magic.
Well, that's so pretty much everything. Yeah, that's pretty much everything that interests me.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about was like recently...
Can't we talk about metallurgy?
Well, we could do that at the end. So something I've been thinking about, which it seems... I've been having a lot of synchronicities happen recently whilst thinking about doing this, which I always take as a good sign.
No, absolutely. Always.
Yeah, so the thing that I've been thinking about a lot and I wanted to discuss with you was that whole kind of... the sort of liminal space that exists between what is real and what isn't, you know, quote, real, and how now that we're currently in this sort of post-truth, everything, you know, fake news, it just seems like that membrane is getting way thinner now.
No, it's not even thinner. It's collapsed. It's over. It's like we're already in the apocalypse. And what I love is that the beautiful minds behind all the variant, you know, explanations of Kabbalah already said there will be an apocalypse. The 32nd path of the world, the universe, the apocalypse and the tarot.
Yeah.
And it basically, the idea is that it pulls the sphere of Malkuth, the purely material sphere which we inhabit when, you know, where particles and things die and entropy reigns, and the sphere of the imagination, which is Yesod, the sphere of the moon.
Mm.
And they said this all these years ago. There will come an apocalypse where the sphere of materiality is pulled up into the sphere of illusion. We're in it. And it could have, you know, to me, it's like you can date it back to Crowley, but it's like 9/11 was suddenly, we're watching a movie spectacle enacted in reality. And no one's recovered from that yet. And, you know, we have VR, we have AR, we have fake news, we have... the entirety of our current human narrative is the collapse of illusion into reality where nothing makes sense. And but magicians can thrive in that climate, I think.
Yeah. But do you think that's been a deliberate coming about? Do you think people have been bringing that about
consciously? Yeah, I can never put it past people to be doing things like this. But, I think who profits? Well, it's people like Donald Trump. It seems to be billionaires who are profiting. It's kind of the Marquis de Sade's 120 Days of Sodom with us as the people in the castle.
Being fed the shit.
Yeah, and destroying the environment, you know, in a way that seems counterproductive to anything, even to capitalism at its worst. So why would you shit in your own nest? But something is clearly going on. But it's the manipulation of reality. From you know, Putin's government, from Vladislav Surkov, the guy who was is advising Putin on these cognitive dissonance techniques.
Yeah.
And that Trump, everyone's following. You just tell a lie. You shat in the carpet. No, I didn't. No, I just watched you. No, you didn't. And that's where we are now. But that's the liminal space you're talking about. That's the tree of life. Malkuth has been drawn up into Yesod.
Yeah.
And I saw it even in... you know, like superhero movies, let's explain Iron Man's powers for real as if it could be real. These things could never be real. These characters are not anywhere, you know, they have barely no relation to reality except as symbolic, you know, images of our higher potential. But in those films, we saw them being concretized. And it's like, here's how it would work. Here's how Batman would work. And he'd end up with back pain. And it's, you know, the imaginary became real. The real became imaginary. Reality TV, nothing is real anymore. And
yeah.
I like being down this rabbit hole, but I can see how disorienting. And people are denying. They're in fucking denial.
Yeah, I think.
But it's happening. This is what the apocalypse looks like. This is where reality and fiction become the same thing. This is what it feels like.
It's like everybody's having a separate one. Yeah. It's like everybody's having like their own little.
And it's all individual and it's super polarized, like Manichaean religion, like every. But it's not just God versus the devil, Ormazd versus Ahriman. Hmm. It's no longer. It's just everyone versus everyone. It's every particle versus every other particle.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting, you know, I find it. I find the chaotic nature of it quite interesting. I'm going with the Kenneth Grant thing, where I think Horus is handing over to his sister, Matt,
yeah,
the goddess of truth, and things are going to cool down a little bit soon.
I hope so. It just seems like every day there's just like a new thing. Like even the other day when they announced like the Space Force thing. Did you see that? You must have seen
the
it.
Star
like
Trek
the logo.
Thing. It's brilliant. Captain Kirk would have kicked your ass, how dare you? This isn't the Federation. We don't stand for this. We have no money. We didn't rape the planet. We, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the things that got me thinking about this. I was already halfway down the path, and then it's like
it's
these
illusion
little things
becomes
are jumping
reality.
Up. Yeah.
There's no division anymore. I think we just don't recognize this is what the apocalypse looks like. You thought it would be nuclear, but no, it's this.
Is it the realization that everything's
reality and illusion are now one thing, and it's like it's only going to get even more intricate and complex and weird.
How so? What do you think?
Just more of it. What's, you know, more fake news, more like you can take anyone. I predicted this years ago, like you can take, using computer technology, put Bertrand Russell's head on a porn star. And eventually that'll be the reality of it, you know.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I'm like, I can't wait. I thought Bertrand Russell and who was the other one? I thought it's like basically one of these fabulous 21st century philosophers who you could, you know, we can do this now. The end of reality has begun and we're in it. And I just don't think people are recognising or admitting to it yet.
Who do you think is?
The smart people.
Artists.
And the artists are always, but I think they're still too concerned about the 90s and I don't know.
How so?
Art is a commodity rather than art is self-expression of what it's like to be here now. And I may be wrong, and I cannot speak, I don't know. I don't know, but the young artists who are working there, I bet there's some of them who are totally fucking nailing it.
Yeah, that might be because from my perspective, like when I was at school, I hated school, but the two things that I really loved was music and art.
Yeah, so you had teachers you liked. Those like me, it was English and art.
Yeah,
the rest of it was like kill, you know. But I had good teachers in those disciplines.
Yeah, mine were good too. But it was always like, yeah, but what are you going to do for a job? Because neither of those.
And
things,
how did you answer that question?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say none of them were painted as being viable careers, and they were right. But
my careers officer said you should work in a bank. There's no way. They've got people in America who do this work better than you. And I'm like, no, they don't.
How was that then? Because when did you start writing comics? It was like late
17?
70s. Yeah.
Yeah, I was 17 when I got my first actual paying gig, and it was like £10 a page. Holy shit. But it was very progressive. It was a comic called Near Myths, which was run out of the science fiction bookshop. They're the kind of cool comic store in Edinburgh. And this kid, looking back now, he's a kid, Rob King, but you know, he was the kind of in between hippie and punk, was this little generation of, like Rob King was one.
Yeah.
So he created this magazine. We ran it for like 6 issues. Brian Talbot did Luther Arkwright in there. And which is the Luther Arkwright to me is the progenitor of all, because it's V for Vendetta, it's me, it's Warren Ellis, it's everyone. And Brian Talbot was doing that in 1977. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's, I come up with that. And being able to do that kind of expressive, you know, stuff with the patronage of weird in between hippie and punk guys who had the money was amazing. And at the same time, I was working in DC Thompson doing their space fiction commando stories. and learning that kind of brutal, you know, here's the basics of it. Here's how you tell a story, son. You've no idea. It's three acts. But I love that. I love being taught stuff, you know, like martial arts.
Yeah, because to learn that things, then that's when you get to the point where once you've learned that and you and know you that inside out, you can go apart. Yeah.
But it's sound advice always. It's like, oh, here's a trick I can always go back to if you have to prove to people you know this stuff, you know.
Yeah, because for me, when I was told that, I looked at the two things. I think art seemed like the one that I might have well, I could do graphic design or I could do this. And music just always sat on the back burner. And then as it turned out, you know, when you obsess about something enough, it will suddenly bloom in front of you.
But that's the thing, isn't it? You have to embrace that, that thing that you love.
And then, you know, for all the mistakes that you do, I think I ended up in the right place, and it seems to have worked for you as well.
I know, but again, you'll see them as mistakes, or it's just an inevitable path through space-time.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't feel like mistakes. It feels like, isn't it great we sit with this backdrop talking about this kind of stuff? It's brilliant that things could bring us to this confluence of events, you know?
Yeah. When did you know that it was the right way forward?
But I don't know if it is. I'm just a product of my environment. <laughs> Yeah,
but as a reaction to your environment, you've
no, but my environment was great. Yeah, my mother, my mom and dad were activists, and they were they didn't. My mother didn't have me till I was 30. My dad was 35, so they were already smart, but they were just poor working class people.
Hmm.
They were activists against nuclear proliferation, so I was taken on marches. My dad actually broke into bases and did all this stuff, so you can see a lot of that in my work and the Invisibles and this obsession with underground places and conspiracies and the fact that, you know, the ruling elites have it all over us, because my dad could, you know, he could see all these things. He could photograph the interior. We saw coffins stacked up with everyone's names on them.
Wow.
For the nuclear war and pencil sharpeners. That was my thing. It's like pencil sharpeners. But now even I'm thinking, did I see that, or was it just my dad telling me?
Yeah.
But it's all in the work, I think.
That's such a wild time, though. I remember sitting in, I've said this before, I swear it was like a chemistry class or a physics class, and being shown, like, you know, that classic film where it shows, like, the house and the trees of, like, from the blast. And it was like...
But it was all that haunted in my dreams, and I know it haunted the dreams of an entire generation of people.
Yeah.
But it was very much there, but my parents were against it and fighting it, and they were not winning, you know. My dad was a hero. He'd been a soldier in the war. He was like... But he was a radical working-class activist. My mother was an intelligent woman who didn't get to college, who just became the wife of a radical working-class activist. So... They had all this thing going on that I grew up with, but I could see that they were failing to fight this monster. And for me, it was like I found a Superman comic. Superman's taking the bomb in his chest, the atom bomb's like, yeah, it tickles.
Yeah. And
imaginatively, that was the salvation. It was like, okay, beyond the bomb, the thing that my mother and father are so scared of, the A-bomb, the atom, the fucking end of the world, Superman just laughs at that. And the Hulk only begins his story when that occurs, you know, and suddenly it's all, and the mutants come from that. And the comics, honestly, imaginatively, give me a space to escape that existential post-war horror.
Great days. It just seems
they'll be back.
Well, they are back, I think. I feel like
all those nukes are still there. We've still got, I live, where we live, it's beautiful. It's like Lord of the Rings, like the Loch in the mountains. But right across the water, the subs go up and down, and they have 50 times the firepower, apparently, to annihilate all living things on Earth. 50 times. Like, how do... That's like, but that's like the Mahabharata, that's like Brahma. Yeah. It's like these mega doses of extinction. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's... Yeah, all right. Well, that's an interesting point, because I only read Nameless recently, and it feels like... You're saying about you know, those the great wars in heaven, that seems like a like a recurring thing. Yet another thing I noticed with that, Zibalba, and then also was so terrible with Barbalith as and then how those these kind of things that hover outside of just outside
yeah, it's
of
the
art.
Liminal space again yeah talking, it's the space between the frames
like Valis you know, and, yeah. yeah
and that's why I identified with Valis or you know the pink light or zebra or whatever Philip K. Dick was talking about because yeah. I never read his books but I read his biography and I loved the guy you know but yeah it's the liminal space and for me the Babla thing I was a little kid on a bus so for me it's always something real it's something concrete and I'm on a bus when I'm small I'm stopped at the light and I became absorbed it was like a peak experience for a child in this red light and then it was the change from red to green oh green means go yellow through yeah. green means go and that became a whole important symbolic event that I couldn't explain you know all I could do is put it in the comic and say this was immense for reasons I cannot articulate
do you look back on those things and think about them now
yeah
do you understand them a yes. bit better
no I get it now but it's some things are beyond words you know there are experiences that are beyond yeah. beyond articulation but you try to put them in something so I get that badly that weird
Well, that's what makes your job so difficult to take these ideas and thought forms and
it never feels difficult never you know
how do you write because I know you draw a lot right
I draw everything out first and all the comics I draw them and like Todd McFarlane called me you're doing all these shadows and like you know it's like the entire background I was like drawing little tiny comics back when my eyes could handle this shit
yeah
and they were tiny this mad they should be reproduced you know some of them have been I've got all of them but they're nuts they're like super like detailed like with backgrounds and shadows and everything worked to the tiniest miniaturist madness detail
So is that how you plot everything out? Mm. Or are you literally, would you write a story and then the second draft of it almost would be the visualization?
No, the visual always comes first. And wow. For comics, always.
Well, I mean, it makes sense, I guess.
For comics, well, if you're doing something else, then it's something else. But comics, it's I have to draw the page. I have to see, like, bang, you turn the page and you get this. It's, you know, it's a delivery system of keeping people turning the page, making, you know, giving them excitement, always having a cliffhanger at the end of every page or...
Is that something from childhood? Because the whole kind of just from reading serialized stuff.
I think that's what television's ended up like, which is why it's been fun to embrace that because they took the storytelling modes of Stan Lee comics, basically, and you know these endless recurring narratives, and translated it to television.
I feel like we're jumping ahead of all the things I want to talk about. Yeah. No, that's cool.
It's your fault, it's not me.
Yeah, sorry. I feel like I'm jumping around a bunch. Something else that I was thinking
just keep going back to your touchstones.
Yeah. So the other thing saying about, you know, having, you know, read Nameless and the idea of the meteor and stuff, then because I've been thinking about this loads, another one of these synchronicities, you know, when like a news thing will just come up on your phone, it said about, it was the thing about Jupiter and like scientists have now think that Jupiter for this entire time has either been shielding us from or just lobbing stuff towards us
depending on how it feels that day you know it's like Jupiter daddy's angry firing a 50 ton missile at us but that's giving it intention that's anthropomorphizing the whole concept so I don't know
do you not
No, I do. I think it's all multidimensional. Every aspect of it helps to understand the truth.
Because then,
Jupiter is a thinking entity that sometimes thinks, "Fuck you, you haven't been paying enough attention." But Jupiter is also, it's like an astrological sign. It's a set of correspondences.
Yeah,
all of this is true. You know, it's also just a rocky planetoid with a gaseous atmosphere that has no intention. Yeah. But somehow it seems to be doing stuff, you know. So I think it's all, like I say, everything's prismatic. Everything, you have to see all the faces of it to understand what's real. You know, Blake would say the sun is a convocation of angels blazing, singing harmony. a scientist would see a, you know, a stellar object with this mass and this, you know, a nuclear fusion. But all of those things are true. All I was those say, versions
can be all those things.
All the, you know, is all of those things even, no matter even ones you don't agree with.
Yeah.
And I think to understand the actual immensity of the concept at the center of that, you have to understand every single angle of what it might be, how it could be described, and that accounts. That's also everything, which is, you know, the prismatic view of things could drive you nuts, but you have to, I think you have to take advantage of all the potential perspectives.
And I think whereas before scientism would always be that, no, we've reached the peak of where we're at, so let's take everything off that doesn't fit in with our worldview.
Yeah.
Now they're having to change all that. And if you are to then follow that down, you know, follow that thread down a rabbit hole, that you get to the point where you decide, yeah, consciousness is not something that is a result of matter and it is its own thing. And what's to say that those things aren't part of some universal consciousness? This sounds like I'm high.
No, now you've done it. No, I think consciousness is absolutely, you can relate it all to matter. It's like, consciousness is the sum total of the universe thinking about itself, and especially us. We don't have anyone. I mean, there might be fabulous aliens out there thinking higher level, but so far it's us and all the animals, and they've got ways of thinking about it we haven't even learned to talk about yet. But it's us thinking about it, and that's it.
Yeah, because you could then look at that as the sense that we are just appendages from which something is experiencing itself.
No, it's just, imagine you're a cell in a body. They die all the time, they flake off, but they're all part of your body.
Yeah.
And they will persist, and they're super organized machines, these tiny little things that do stuff and communicate with each other, but they slough and die. But you persist, and I think it's that on a larger scale, and it's just everything is holographic. You know, just look to the smallest and you'll see the structure of the largest.
Yeah, as above.
Yeah.
So above.
Which, of course, you know, the Hermetic thinkers were already there. All those, the Greeks were doing this. I mean, primitive people were doing this because they had brains just as big as ours, but different frameworks.
Yeah.
You know, it was interesting. I'm sorry, I'm babbling, but...
No, I'm into it.
No, but, I said to Kristen, what did the Aboriginal people in Australia think about the fires? And she went and checked it out, and like, they had all kinds of defences. That's a culture that goes back 60,000 years. Aboriginal people have an 11-dimensional model of time, which is like the furthest string theory versions we have. They already did it. It's a 60,000-year-old culture. And we're not talking to them about this. And they have all kinds of defences and barriers and things. Here's what you can do. Here's what you can do. And you're not talking to them. So,
yeah.
And it might be more than 60,000 years, but they figured it all out. Imagine an 11-dimensional theory of time.
Yeah, because again, that's just like I was saying about the idea of like everything that's on the table is like, this is what how we view things. This is how it is. This is the accepted theory of what reality is. But
I think it's all consciousness, though. You know, we have this idea of the more complex things become, like a single bee is not very smart, but a beehive is super smart. You know, a termite is not very smart, but a termite mound is pretty organized. So all you have to do is to think that out. What's the most complex structure we know? The universe. Of course it's organized. It's an emergent structure. It's conscious. It's as simple as that. And we're very good receivers because we have so many, we've got all these neurons, we've got all this shit going on, we're really good radios.
Yeah.
I think consciousness is everything, and we're just receivers for it, and we're good receivers so we can reflect and do all this stuff. But I think it's all consciousness, everything's, that chair's got its own sense of the heat has changed the thing, but it's not thinking, it's...
I agree. I was thinking back to when I sort of first became aware of your work. And I think aside from like stuff in 2000 AD and a couple of things in Warrior.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the thing where it really...
Are you going back at least?
I'm older.
Yeah.
I remember...
You look lovely. You've defied time.
So do you. Yeah, I remember like convincing my dad to buy me Warrior from our local news agents.
Oh, I love Warrior.
That's so like, great.
A revelation.
To be a kid, to read that was just mm-hmm. everything that was going on with it, with like Spiral Path and Shandor.
All the stuff I love.
Yeah. And and V, and it was just like, it was quite the eye opener.
V was like Dennis Potter doing superheroes. This is great. This is like, you know. It really felt like all the stuff I loved on TV in the 70s and all that amazing flowering of imagination that was on television. It just felt like, here's the comic. This is everything I want to do, you know.
Was it very inspiring for you then?
Yeah, yeah. Because I've been trying. I did Near Myths and we were a dry run for... It wasn't even adult comics. It was just, here's cool sci-fi. This the shit we're into. There's Brian Talbot doing Luther Artwright, which, like I say, was a template of this stuff.
I think I've got some... There were standalones done of that a while, like, back in the day, weren't there? Because I swear I've got some, like... They were very, like, black and... They were just black and white with, like, orangey... I'm sure that he...
No, it was all just black and white, but Talbot, he was basically the leading light and the engine of our train. But... That was happening, and for me, I'd grown up with Jim Starlin and Don McGregor and all those psychedelic kids who were doing Marvel comics, doing Doctor Strange and Warlock and, you know, stuff that's now becoming the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But
which is a trip.
But I'd grown up with that, and Steve Gerber, and these just satirists. And that was my idea of what comics were. It was this big, mad adult thing.
Yeah.
So when Warrior came along, it was, here's the British version. It's like, oh, my dream come true. Near Myths didn't work out, but they've discovered how to make it work, and they had just it was brilliant. It was very inspiring. Yeah,
it was an exciting time then, I imagine.
But and then you'd all that, the explosion of the small press and the independent press, that like Ryan Hughes and, you know, Paul Gravett stuff and all those comics that come out of that.
It was really punk as well.
Yeah.
Well, like you said, it was that kind of weird middle ground between punk and psychedelia.
Yeah, we'd all grown up with comics, and we had ideas. We couldn't wait to be unleashed, and suddenly the floodgates were open. You could do this, which was like punk. You can make a record, you know?
Yeah. The thing for me, where it really clicked with your stuff for me, was Arkham Asylum.
Yeah.
I think, to be fair, Dave McKean's artwork had a lot to do with that, because as somebody that was an aspiring...
No, Dave couldn't be without him. It's like, I think my script is kind of great, but I was imagining a Brian Boland. I thought it'd be super like grungy, every piece of dirt. But Dave was so much better, and I think that's why it survived. It's like, there's nothing like it.
Because
there is nothing like it, and he was antagonistic to the whole concept of having to do Batman. He's a fine artist, a jazz musician. He's like, and he's like, no. So the conflict between me and him, I was trying to do the killing joke, basically, you know, like a super realistic, dirty David Lynch.
Yeah.
And he was, no, I'm doing this big symbolic drama based on my heroes, Baron Story, you know, the illustrators that he loved. And that's honestly, without him, it wouldn't be what it is at all. It's him that people love. It's him, the art students come, and he's like, he delivers. It's like, this is Batman, like, art students, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but it was the marrying of the two things that made it so...
No, I think because the underlying story, people forget, it's really quite tight, and it's a thriller, you know?
Yeah.
Set across two times, a mad story, a horror story. And it's quite circular and tight, but I think he brought such chaos to it, you know, people forget.
Yeah, well, that was brilliant. A great period for comic art, like him and Sienkiewicz like Kent Williams.
But it was Dave breaking away from those influences as well, and you can see it, like the anger. And, you know, and he's got Gustav Klimt pages.
Fully. Like figures that like quite sheelish and gaunt.
Yeah, and it's like,
awesome.
I do not want to draw Batman. So it's kind of brilliant for that, and I think that's why it's still around and people still like it.
Well, it's 30th anniversary last year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't even realise that. I saw them. I'm so gutted because I wanted to bring it with me,
because I got him to sign it when I first bought it. And I was like, fuck, I need to bring that with me just so I can go, yes. But I left it on my fucking table. But there you go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
But he was great. We went on a tour, and it was the first time I'd been to America, and it was just amazing. But
I'm
traveling with Dave to Chicago, and his beard froze in the 25 seconds between the taxi and the hotel. It was minus 28. And he's, wow. I remember just watching crystallized. But then his nose bled, and he could do this amazing imitation of what's his name? South Bank Show did.
Oh, Melvin Bragg.
Yeah. He was on, and he kept saying David Hockney. It was so Dave was brilliant.
Why do you think that has stood the test of time so much? Because it is
it's because it's the art Batman. It's the Euro Batman. Again, we wanted it to be this is Bowie and Berlin Batman.
Yeah,
you know, and we were watching those Quay movies and Bob Schwankmeyer, Jan Schwankmeyer, those puppets. You got to see this stuff.
I don't know that.
No, you must, then you'll love it. But Schwankmeyer was it's Czechoslovakian, maybe. I could be wrong. But he made these brilliant movies. It was like stop motion.
Oh, okay.
Animations. A lot of people copied his style.
Like the Brothers Key.
Yeah, Brothers Key copied that style. Okay. So it was things coming to life and regurgitating.
And then Tool, obviously, yeah.
So we were looking at that. We were looking at, you know, like Kenneth Anger and all this, like.
Yeah.
Like alternative stuff. We just thought, listen, Frank Miller had done this ultimate American Batman, the kind of Scorsese dark Batman. We thought, let's do the Euro Batman, where Batman's this fucked up German expressionist figure and the Joker's the master of ceremonies from Cabaret.
Yeah.
And that was where it came from. It's like, here's Euro Batman.
Do you remember when it came
People
out?
People hated it.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know.
It got such a mega build-up, and they were saying, oh, the hype. And I was like, I kept denying, no, it's just a book. It's just our take. It's just, but they hated it when it came out.
Where, over there or?
In Britain, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I was seen as super pretentious. And I was constantly trying to live this down, pretentious. I'm just a working class kid. I'm so sorry. I didn't go to university.
It just feels really artful to me.
Well, I honestly think it's great. And it's survived, but it is this. It's goth. It's like really,
yeah.
It's just a thing. It's like if you're an art student, you're gonna love this version of Batman.
Yeah, that's probably why it resonated for me. And like you said, because I think at that point that was when I'd first. I don't know when was it 89.
89.
So I would have been. So
two.
I was 2 years old.
Yeah, and you love Batman.
I was like, yeah, I would have been like 17, and it was by that point, I think I'd already started getting, I'd been quite far down the whole sort of like.
Were
esoteric.
You reading the British stuff, or were you reading all that stuff?
Yeah, and I'd already started to get into magic a bit as well, and had a few.
But what got you into that?
What magic?
Where did that come from?
I don't know. I guess just because. I don't know, actually. I guess it's because of the sort of things I was into. I was into a lot of art. But my mum was, like, it was a running joke that she was really witchy.
Mm-hmm.
But she would always deny it. But then if somebody got a wart in the family, she'd be like, let me go and get a bit of bacon. We'll rub that on there, and then we'll go and bury it in the garden. And I was bacon. Like, what are you talking about? But So it was like weird, almost like folk magic things going on. But
I know, but don't you think every family has that? So what drew you to something?
I don't know.
It's not folk magic you're talking about. It's slightly, you know, it's a different kind of.
But you feel it, don't you? I think we all do. When
yeah,
when
my
you,
mum was super. Well, she was into magic. She read tea leaves. But I was a skeptic. I've never seen a ghost. You all talk about this shit. I don't fucking believe any of this.
So what changed it?
I did a Crowley ritual and I thought, this is bullshit.
Which one?
It was what the boneless. The boneless.
Okay, yeah, headless.
Like,
yeah, yeah. Leave a Samek.
No, so I didn't even know.
How old were you when you did that?
19.
Oh, okay.
So I'm and I didn't take drugs. I didn't fucking, I didn't drink. I didn't take even coffee. Nothing passed my lips. I was like a straight edge, little, you know, minister in my mod, you know, thing. But I did this and I thought, okay, I'll show me something. So I did the ritual and I lay back and I'm on nothing. And I got the whole, I'm in the white hot room. You know, and it's like all these mages of times past and things like, you know, holy fuck. And it was for real.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I did the thing and this was all like, I could talk myself out of it because I had imagined it.
Yeah.
And it was here and it was a spiral. It was the entire universe flushing down the plug hole, which has been a repeated motif.
Yeah.
But then at night, I woke up in the middle of the night and there's this pressurized space above me, like collapsing all the perspectives and the, you know, the visual field was descending into this hole, and there was just this thing like siphoning into my brain. But then the lion appears and it's like, I am neither north nor south, I am, you know, forget. So
yeah,
for me it was like, okay, this is actually, I just did something that changed my consciousness considerably, that didn't involve drugs, that didn't involve anything other than he said this would happen if I did this, and he was right. So that changed everything and I just began to explore.
Yeah.
Then I went through my entire 20s, this little mod boy, just doing magic, reading tarot, making it up.
Yeah.
You know, and then I got to 32 and I thought, I'll drink and I'll take psychedelics and see what else I can get. And the rituals, the gods became visual in a way that before they were just distortions, weirdness, like collapses of perspective. And then you're tripping and it's like, oh, right, that's what you look like. And
yeah.
So it was that was fascinating, but it was all done in the service of what? I do not fucking believe this. You're talking shit.
Has that ever smacked you on the arse, thinking like that?
Always, but I don't care. It's like, it's always, no, it's a story. I've had demons and like the monsters, the scorpions, and I'm like, you do know I'm just going to put this in a story and make money out of you.
But then that's essentially maybe why it's happening.
No, but they still, it's like, okay, we stung you. It's like, you're good. That's a story too.
These things want to live. In whatever manner you can provide.
And I
right?
let them live. I said, like, you can be my story.
Hmm.
I almost died in 1996. I had this Staph aureus infection and I was doing it in the Invisibles. And I just said to the infection, if you let me live, I'll make you the major villain in this story.
Yeah.
And you will be this infectious viral horror that's, you know, taking over reality. And they're like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's something I find really interesting, the way you've put yourself in a lot of your work. Because I think people probably think
it's... The fascinating thing was, it was like, and after that, I was obsessed with carrots. I was like, I had to have carrots. But no, the Staph aureus bug, the reason it's called Staph aureus, it's golden staph, because it's carotene rich.
Really?
So all the bugs were dead, and all I wanted was carrots to replace the bulk of death that had been in me.
Wow. That's nuts. I think the two things go so hand in hand with like with creativity and magic. See, this when I normally do this, it's more than likely with people from bands, and we'll talk a bit about we'll talk about what's going on in the record that you've just done and da 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 da. But then we always get to this point where I'm like, well, it's magic, isn't it? And
And you know, but magic is just a
thing. It's a, we all own it. It's a, that's why it's the working class. It's like all of us. Hmm. Magic is just a way of making meaning, you know?
But do you think that...
magic is meaning. It's simple as that. And you can develop that further into martial arts. But the basis of magic is meaning, right? You're sitting in this room. That's not just a chair. That's the throne of the, you know, king of heaven. Well, that's not just... do you make the meaning?
Hmm.
If you don't make the meaning, it becomes clipothic. It's the shell of everything.
Yeah.
And meaning is just, that's all it is. How much meaning can you apply to that building over there? Oh, it's a Masonic temple that's dedicated to the destruction of the planet Earth by drawing down, you know, fire from heaven and uniting with the oil underneath us and like destroying the planet because oil wants a desert. You can make stories out of everything.
Yeah.
Magic is meaning. The meaning of my life is that I will do this. I'll ascend to this. I'll be in a band. I'll pretend to be someone I'm not. Mm. And it will work. You know, that's yeah. magic. It's all magic. It's not a fucking thing for dudes in robes and hats. It's our birthright. It's our, we make meaning. We can take control just by making meaning.
Well, I think that was why when you've got someone like Genesis Peorage, I feel like what she did with Topi in that whole period, that it made, that was exactly that, wasn't it? It was making an egalitarian thing, and it was taking it away from the OTO still, and the Golden Dawn. But
yeah, I agree. It wasn't, it was no longer the collegiate version of magic.
Like,
you know,
Etonian
which is,
magic almost.
But I kind of also respect that, you know, the Hogwarts.
I do as well.
But
like
you can
it,
rise up through that, and there are judges, like, you know, like Rodney Orpheus is my friend. It's there are levels of, we have tests to see if you've attained this state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Don't fucking lie about it. So I kind of, that's okay. But at the same time, I think, you know, I'm more drawn to the non-binary, the queer fucking current.
Yeah.
Wider, you know, Mayan, voodoo, Polynesian.
Are you a big Spare fan?
No, I always hated him.
How weird. Come?
I couldn't get into it at all.
But I find that, I mean, he's
the, I know he's like the one that should be. No, I like
I'm
Crowley.
Surprised. Okay, see, I'm the opposite.
Yeah,
because I always
Spare
I mean,
just does not connect with me at all, but I know he should because I know his stuff is like, yeah, come on.
But what you're doing is a lot of what you do seems to be very much in that camp almost. But maybe, yeah, I guess if the guy doesn't resonate with you, that's one thing. But it does seem like,
you have to ask then why. It's
like, yeah, like your thinking seems to be quite in parallel with his, especially as you're saying about the whole non-binary thing and him having like the idea of the neither, where it's like neither.
But all of that, but even that, that's so Victorian,
and,
you know.
It's very of a time.
So for me, there's all the you know, Advaita, the you know, Buddhism, Dzogchen. It's like none of that appears in this kind of Western oriented thing, you know, and just female magic, the Bina, the sphere of Bina, which is where I feel I finally got after the abyss, was to that, the Black Panther goddess. So I think there's a lot more going on. There's a lot more interesting metaphors that we could be drawing from rather than just the simple Western male tradition of the Logos, you know, the word, the written word, that age is over, Osiris.
But you're a Kenneth Grant fan, though, right?
Yeah, I like the kind of girly nature of it all.
Yeah.
And his, that Matt, I think it really has to be, it's Wonder Woman, it's the goddess of truth. Matt, you know, we cannot destroy structures anymore. We have to progress them. And Matt, is, Horus is all about kicking it down. He's the jihadi boy.
Yeah. You know?
That version of Horus, you know, the Lord of Flame and force and fire.
Well, I'd like you. You could see that when
it's very destructive. That again, it's like it's the destruction of the towers. It's like the breakdown of reality. That's Horus. It's like, but I think I love Kenneth Grant because it's the Aeon of Matt is happening simultaneously, and she comes up, And we're seeing it, you know, the Me Too movement, the queer fringes coming in and talking and getting angry. And like, you know, I think that's that. That's what my Wonder Woman book's been about. That's what Brave New World's about. It's this, you know, let the girls do it. I'm happy to sort of you do your thing. I'm sure it will fuck up eventually, but...
That's definitely the vibe of Nameless, I think, as well, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The handover, just Horace, stop kicking things down. We can develop it. We can take what you got and make it more beautiful. You know?
Yeah.
We'll plant flowers in the top of your towers. We'll, like, you know?
Yeah. I wanted to talk about TV, especially because when I started watching Happy, I hadn't made the connection that it was you, I don't think. I think I just was on Netflix and was like, oh, this looks cool. And then, like, the penny dropped really quick, obviously.
When my name appeared.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I've really enjoyed it. It's been one of the few TV series in you know, both seasons of it have been amazing. And I think...
All the actors are great, and he's brilliant.
It's he's amazing. Yeah. How was that moving into that?
Just great. I mean, I had the best experience. I mean, I know people hate this thing, but I just everyone was brilliant on that show, and I was in the room with them, and we're talking all the stuff out and creating the what the show became. So no, it was brilliant. I loved it.
Yeah.
I love the collaborative thing because usually I sit on my own struggling with, oh, I'm on page 10. Shit, there's 22 pages of this. But you're in a room and you just throw it over to this fabulous, you know, young woman who's a Caltech scientist. And it was like, boom.
And you were very open to that then, the collaboration?
No, it's brilliant. I want to learn. It was like the dojo. It was like, wow, these are people who are like solving narrative problems, and they've got different methods from me, so I can learn. It's like, you know, the crane method,
yeah, like, absorbing it all.
Yeah,
but did that throw like the main, like, you had everything mapped out where you were going with it as
no,
it goes
no you have it mapped out, and then you start talking and everyone's got ideas apart. So it becomes like, let's make it better, let's do this, let's like push this element of it. And that's great, but I think you have to have it mapped out. You have to know what you're doing, and then people will make it better, hopefully.
I kind of want to talk about a lot of that, but I'm also conscious that we're nearly 50
now you've
minutes.
Done it.
Yeah. So now you're in that world, and I think that there's a bunch of really great comic book, I guess, adaptations, but those universes now coming across into I was going to say new medium, but it's not a new medium, is it? You sure? Okay, you could have said, I don't mind.
Kill him.
Yeah. Just stop talking, it says. Thank you. Yeah. So with stuff like Umbrella Academy, which I thought he's done amazing with.
Yeah.
The Boys, which I thought was...
It's good.
I thought it was ace.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved that it actually went there, and Preacher I really enjoyed as well. It feels like now, whereas that stuff before, it felt very... it felt like people's perceptions of what comics were that weren't involved in comics. Do you know what I mean? It always was like very tongue-in-cheek and a bit naff.
In television now, there's so many shows. There's like 500 what shows and all these streaming services.
Yeah.
And it feels more like Vertigo. And in the 90s, it was this sense that you can do anything. That we're really open to individual voices because things have to stand out. They have to be shocking or provocative or whatever.
Yeah.
So suddenly you find yourself like, this is like 1993 when I was doing The Invisibles and Sebastian O. It's like Vertigo. It's
That's
that
awesome.
Feeling.
Yeah, because I feel like...
And how much of that eventually gets there, but I think we've done it. It's, you know, Happy is really like the comic book, and then it's a whole new take on the comic book in season two.
And it just seemed like when I... Like, the X-Files was really pushing that whole thing, and it became like a real focus within society for people, because, you know, again, it was like you said, there weren't the streaming services, and it felt like that was the thing that was kind of pushing forward a bit and exploring new ideas and bringing magic and
the occult and the esoteric. And now it's everything. It's like we're fighting each other to be expressed, you know.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
So that leads...
So the weirdest visions, the most individual visions, can now actually make it to the screen and be seen by people.
Yeah.
In a way that comics aren't anymore. You know, comics are a niche. It's like poetry in the 18th century.
But people are ready for it now as well, I think. Was before, like, you couldn't have done...
And all those techniques were from comics, the long-form storytelling, the... You know, arcs and seasons, and like you can keep these characters running and coming back, and soap opera. It's all Stan Lee.
Yeah. Yeah. But then he was taking that from Flash Gordon and the early Tarzan and stuff, I guess. So it's this thing that kind of feeds in on itself and then out and then back in. But so this is something I wanted to talk about, because I know that you've previously said that you were speaking to the BBC a long time ago about The Invisibles, right?
Yeah, yeah, way back.
When was that? Like, quite soon?
1998, 1999.
And what happened with that?
I wrote 2 scripts, got paid, nothing happened.
Yeah. Do you look back now and think that was probably a blessing?
Yeah, yeah. There's a new version coming, so.
Yeah. When? I know that you've been working on it, because I saw
you
that you...
killer, it's destroyer.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah, but that's it. Can I see what you see it? You see it. Look, you can have Kristen hovering over him.
Well, you're far into it, right?
Yeah. Is it? No, it's. I'm so excited. It's like it's everything that it was in the 90s. This is it for now.
Yeah. And how far into it are you? Oh, I'm really curious now. Like, you've...
Oh, it's like...
Is it a full adaptation or is it...
No, but it's like a whole new thing.
Okay.
In this world now, what we've been talking about, you know, is that.
Amazing.
Then it's not Jack Frost or Dane. It's like it's Ragged Robin.
Okay.
But it's her young self, and she meets herself. Like, she has to bring herself up. And she hates her. They hate each other. It's like... Imagine meeting your 16-year-old self.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's one of those things where, like, I think at the age I'm at now, I always say, oh, if I could go back and tell 15-year-old me, that's a lovely idea.
He would be going, no, fuck you.
Yeah, he'd be like,
fuck you, you're fucking weirdo.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. That's really exciting.
But that's only... I'm very excited about it. It's
great.
It's been the passion that it was then, but for now, and it's like totally different. And
yeah,
absolutely absorbing the stuff I've been reading. You know, the way the world works is diseased.
Yeah,
these awful old men that are running things.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. It's just that as soon as you start to think about that stuff, it can be so crushing. Like, I talked to my son about it. He's 21. And he's...
He's growing up then. So what's his take on it?
He's like, we're fucked.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's what I said when I was...
But imagine, it's worse, because we keep telling kids this myth. It's all over. You're doomed. You're fucked. We're deliberately diminishing their potential to defy that.
But then that's what it was like for us at that age as well.
No, I was never told it was doomed. I was told I could change the world. Are you different?
I don't know.
My parents said you could do anything. You could write a novel. You could direct a film. You could, you know.
Yeah.
And they were nothing.
Yeah, I don't
think
they had
nothing.
My parents
were, you know,
unsupportive. Yeah. But you know, my dad was a bricklayer. His dad was a bricklayer, and his dad
was a
bricklayer.
So what were you told?
And like,
what did you think when you did this? You know.
I don't know. I just remember that for me, there was a moment where. So we had a coal fire where we lived. Mm-hmm. And I would go out. This sound makes it sound like that, like the 1850s.
It's like Monty Python.
Yeah, exactly.
The Yorkshireman.
Yeah.
I lived in a car bomb box.
I don't want
it. It was 2 inches by 2 inches square.
Luxury.
Luxury.
Well, that's, yeah, I'm very wary that it's going to descend into that. But I remember thinking that
my dad finally like was taking my art seriously and my music seriously when I went out to chop. This does sound like the 1800s. When I go out to chop wood and he wouldn't let me do it anymore. He went, no, I don't want you.
No, artists don't do that.
No, because I think he thought if I took one of my fingers off, then I would be fucked.
Fuck, wow. So was that a moment for you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, when I look at it now, yeah, very much so.
So you grew up where?
Just outside of Reading. It was what it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to sit and complain about it now.
But, no need to make excuses, old man.
But, and it wasn't that they weren't supportive, far from it, I think. Yeah. But it just felt that there was this overbearingness within society where it probably felt like we couldn't, you know, it's like, yeah, just shut up and get on with what's going to be allotted to you. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I talk to him now and I feel like now I'm way more, I don't know whether I'm actually more optimistic because of my outlook on everything or if I'm just trying to paint an optimistic picture because I don't want my kids to be miserable.
Just being optimistic to be evil because there's no, you know, you're not allowed to be. It's impossible. But just for that reason.
Yeah.
But I love Greta Thunberg. I hate the way people hate that young woman, you know.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. Mm. And I think the way, I don't care what's going on with her social media account, whether it's like a bunch of people doing it, but fuck me, she's like, every time that guy has said something about her, she's just changed a little thing and everybody turns around and laughs at him and it's amazing.
Imagine she was a robot. You did Poppy in Titanic, didn't you? I loved that whole Poppy thing where she was just being the Britney Spears, the mind-controlled Alice in Wonderland, MKUltra thing, you know? Yeah. It was brilliant.
It was playing on that whole, that archetype, you know? Like, you look at like sites like Vigilant Citizen, you know, those weird websites where it's like, I guess they're almost like, there's like this almost sort of fundamentalist Christian.
Yeah, but you've read that, you know, the MK Ultra things, which the girls all have to do on Alice in Wonderland, but that's part of the mind control, the brainwashing. Yeah. And they've all got a video. And they just took that and turned it into an art project. I loved that thing.
Yeah, amazing. Like, you know, what was weird though, was when I did it with them, there were so many, I was fucking walking to the hotel to do the thing and it kept happening. There was like little things that were just like, it was, and I walked into the, I walked into the hotel and the hotel, the first thing you see is just a bunch of, like about 15 sort of, you know, like masks, like those kind of white masks that you get in almost Eyes Wide Shut kind
Deep
of.
Drama, kind
of. Yeah. So there was all of those on the wall. And then I get in the lift and the whole lift is themed with The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, these are all the things.
The trigger things. Trigger images of, you know, US culture.
Yeah, that are allegedly within all these programs. And then we get into the room and the entire room is split down the middle like a chessboard. So there's white and then black and then black and white. The whole thing, and on painted onto the wall of our hotel room.
It's Gwen Stefani.
It was the Tin Man painted as an outline on
robotic
the wall.
Humanity.
And I was just like, are you fucking kidding?
But everyone knows this. That's what I get. I look at these conspiracies, and this is happening. You know, it's like Jay-Z and Beyonce. They're reading the same shit you are.
Yeah.
And they're just turning it into pop art.
Yeah. Well, that's what we talked to them about. It is an art
form. All
of
this imagery is available to everyone now. We can all pretend to be mind control slaves of the elite. Mm. We can all pretend. And that's, again...
Or is it a double bluff?
Yeah, it's a super nuts illusion and reality is now gone.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what we started talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's crazy.
It has become one thing. Yes, Odin and Malkuth are now one thing. But the symmetry of the tree is now fixed.
Yeah. Yeah, but which side of it are we on? Front side or the back side of it? Do you know what I mean? It feels like... It's really clipothic and...
But that's... Because that's sexy. So, but it's not. I think we're just playing with that because the Clipoth is always sexy. It's, we don't understand the real Clipoth is just boom, death of affect, death of everything, death of meaning.
Yeah.
Weird. The Clipoth you're talking about is just sexy, dirty, obverse of civilization. That's not the Clipoth. The Clipoth is all. Oh, it's like nothing. It means nothing. Nothing means end.
Saying about the idea of these people that are like the ruling elite, you're not particularly into the idea of aliens, are you?
No.
But do you?
I'm a skeptic. I just like. I think it's all just.
Mind, though.
No, I think it's all just human conscious states. This seems real in this circumstance.
Yeah.
Like I mean, they could do way better than this. The Daleks. The Daleks come in and destroy and turn people into Robo-men. Where are these? Show yourself.
Hmm.
I think
yeah,
it's
but
just
then
us.
If you're
we,
trying to get
no,
something
we are
done.
The, don't you feel an alien? Don't that's why we love David Bowie, because he said, this is what it feels like to be an alien.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, because then you start looking into panspermia and the idea about...
It's all already done. We're all aliens. It's not...
Yeah, you know? I think that's the conclusion people
are going to
get to. And
that's why it feels so creepy sometimes.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree, actually. You read a lot... Like, you've read a lot of Peter Lavender's stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I was reading some of his fairly recently from one of the books he's been doing with Tom DeLonge,
mm-hmm.
and the idea about, you know, like about panspermia and like about it being directed. And then he went off on the whole thing about the idea of DNA and RNA being far too complex to have just been something, you know, the whole idea about.
But you know, that's a non-scientist.
What, him?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'm aware of that, but these are ideas we're talking about.
I agree. All the ideas, are, like I said, it's prismatic.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
All,
yeah,
it's all real from this POV.
I find that I've gone so far down one track at times that I'll just my
but
point of view is
we
that
we don't even get it. Look at all, you know, it's all happening simultaneously in all these levels. Like it could be this, it could be that, it could be that.
Okay,
everything
it could
we
be
think
all of those.
About it,
yeah,
but. Everything we think adds to the actual reality of what's being described.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, true. Yeah, because that whole, what I was going to say was that whole thing about, you know, like tornado in a scrapyard and at the end of the tornado, there's a 747 perfectly formed and blah, 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 and how they're saying.
But isn't that history? The idea that there are 747s sitting on runways right now, people just assemble them out of thought, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Why do we hate ourselves? I mean, you know, why do we why do we love the narrative, the gothic narrative of we are Prometheus, we shouldn't have done this, we shouldn't have touched the fire, we shouldn't,
because it's pre-programmed, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But
and
more
but
so
though,
from a societal
know,
level,
why
it's more
be?
Of
what,
a
why
it, genetic...
is that the sexier narrative, is it, why is that, you know?
Because maybe it's true.
And then? Yeah. And
yeah.
Then, you know? And then? Maybe it is, and then?
Yeah.
Can we use it?
Yeah.
As magicians, can we use that? You know, I write stories that might turn you on, that might, you know?
Well, we wouldn't be sat here for a start.
But we can't all be everything, you know, we're just doing a little bit.
Yeah.
And that'll make somebody break into, you know, if my animal man makes somebody save a little rabbit, cool, but that's not, I'm not responsible, I'm just part of the network that says.
Do you not think though, do you not think you're responsible?
No, because I'm part of a social body, it's like Brave New World, I'm just a cell who does this.
An appendage.
Yeah. No, it's not, I'm a cell. And I'll die like a cell in a body, but I do this. And when I'm gone, someone else will do this just like me.
Do you think it would be just like you, though?
Yeah, but just for the times.
Yeah.
A But absolutely, all the stuff we love, all those, yeah, they remember that. They remember those movies or those Play for Today, you know?
Yeah.
They'll just be us for that time.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like cells, like this fall off.
Thank you for listening to episode number 33 of Someone Who Isn't Me. Thank you to Grant for doing it, especially as it was the day before your birthday. Thank you to Kristen for being so generous and helpful with everything, because I have punished her a bunch on email and she's been super cool the whole time. Thank you to Julie for actually introducing us all in the first place. If you want to find out all things Grant, you can go to his website, which is grantmorrison.com, or on his Insta, which is grant.morrison. I can also be found on IG at Daniel P. Carter. You can leave a nice review of the pod on iTunes really easily, and it would be nice and be doing something good. And if Grant's kind of wet your whistle, remember you can check out previous episodes of the podcast with people such as Poppy, as Grant and I discussed during this one. Jazz Coleman, Laura Jane Grace, Marilyn Manson, Alan Moore, etc., etc., etc. Prints can be found on the Death Wish web store. I'm kind of tempted to make prints of this portrait from this episode because I'm pretty stoked how it came out, actually. Let me know on IG if you'd be interested. And I think that's about it. I am out. Peace.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.